Welcome to Q Ideas with Gabe Lyons.
Q is about conversation.
If we're really concerned about ending poverty, we've got to be more concerned about creating justice.
Our cultural products as Christians need to both defy and resonate with the culture.
And God's doing amazing things. His church is expanding. His church is growing.
It's not what's the purpose of my life. It's what is the purpose that's been assigned.
Stay curious. Think well. Advance good. This is Q.
Welcome to another edition of the Q Podcast. And today we're talking about something very serious, something that many people don't understand the depths of this issue or this story. But maybe you're hearing a lot more about it. I hope you are, because back when we invited Brian Stevenson to give this talk at Q 5 years ago, it was a fairly new topic for people to think through. And now today it's becoming much more mainstream, which is why we want to make sure you're understanding this topic and understanding why it's become such a big conversation. And the topic is understanding justice as it relates to our incarceration system in America. Many of you may not know that America actually has the largest and highest rate of incarceration in the world, which should be shocking to some of us. And maybe to some of you go, well, that's a good thing. We do a good job of capturing our criminals and putting them places where they can't harm other people. But if you've been paying attention to the news, you start to understand that many people have been incarcerated for very petty, low crimes. There's also many who've been unjustly incarcerated. And the deeper we go into their stories, start to uncover and understand that, man, maybe our justice system doesn't always work. And if you've never had to participate in it, if you've never been accused of a crime, if you've never had to go to trial, then you actually might not have that much sensitivity or empathy to this discussion, which is why I'm excited that you're going to take the time to listen to this talk by Brian Stevenson, because Brian, he understands this issue. He's the best-selling, New York Times best-selling author of a book called Just Mercy. He's become an incredible advocate since he gave this Q talk over the last 6 years. We've just seen his profile just continue to grow, more and more people taking cues from his leadership and his understanding of what's happening. But he's officially the executive director of the Equal Justice Initiative in Montgomery, Alabama, and a professor of law at New York University School of Law. He's won relief for dozens of condemned prisoners. He's argued 5 times now before the Supreme Court and won national acclaim for his work challenging bias against the poor and people of color. He's received numerous awards, including the MacArthur Foundation's Genius Grant. And truly, people look at Brian as an American hero because he's been courageous enough to stand up and speak and educate. And he does his education in a way where he doesn't condemn everybody for not understanding this. He understands that many of us just kind of showed up in a world where it just kind of is this way and we accepted it. And he's now challenging status quo. So let's listen in to this talk, become educated together on what's happening around incarceration in our country and what would it mean for us to restore the justice system.
Challenging in this country to have the kind of conversation that I want to have, because I'm going to suggest that this country has changed in some pretty radical ways over the last 40 years. And I'm going to suggest that it's changed in some ways that are quite disturbing. In 1972, there were 300,000 people in jails and prisons in America. Today, there are 2.3 million. The United States now has the highest rate of incarceration in the world. We have over 6 million people on probation and parole. 1 out of 3 black men between the ages of 18 and 30 is in jail, in prison, on probation, or parole. There are poor and urban communities where over half of the young men of color are under control of the criminal justice system. There are collateral consequences with mass incarceration. In 1996, the Congress passed the Welfare Reform Act, and one of the provisions in that act is that if you've been convicted of a drug crime, you are not permitted to get food stamps or live in public housing or access basic medical care. And in our lifetime, we have created, in my view, this new class of person in American society. They are our untouchables. They cannot even access the fragile public benefit system that we've created. Well, it's not just the way we deal with that population. It has collateral consequences in other areas. Voting. Many states permanently disenfranchise you if you have a criminal conviction. My state of Alabama, where I work, Today, 35% of the black male population has permanently lost the right to vote. We're actually projecting in the next 10 years, the level of disenfranchisement among African-American men in some communities will actually be higher than it was prior to the passage of the Voting Rights Act in the 1960s. And there is this appalling silence around these issues. Not only do we put more people in jails and prisons, we also punish much more harshly. And I believe we actually punish less justly, less fairly, less reliably. We have a criminal justice system in this country, like many of our systems, that is compromised by one underlying reality, and that's wealth. Our system treats you better if you're rich and guilty than if you're poor and innocent. Wealth, not culpability, shapes outcomes. If you don't have the resources to defend yourself, if you don't have the resources to make the investigation, if you don't have the resources to make the case, things don't go so well. And that would be bad in and of itself, but we also have this growing population of poor people in this country. Now, today, 44 million people are living below the federal poverty level. That's actually more than it's been in 50 years. And poverty increases your vulnerability in a society that is engaging in mass incarceration. Well, it's not just poverty, but there's a big part of that. We like to talk about our great system, but we have a system where there is no right to counsel. I represent people on death row, many of whom are literally dying for a lawyer. The right to counsel doesn't extend to the collateral proceedings that have been so effective in exonerating people and showing that people were wrongly convicted. We don't pay people very much. This increase in mass incarceration has been met with a tremendous injection of funds around law enforcement, around judges, around prosecutors, around police services, but not very much on defending. And so this imbalance persists, and poverty makes you vulnerable. But it's not just poverty. Many of the people that we've put in jails and prisons over the last 30 years are people who are mentally ill. We haven't figured out how to deal with the poor who are mentally ill. And when they struggle in our communities, when we see them on the streets, when we see them wandering around, we don't think about mental health solutions. We think about criminal justice solutions. And today there are hundreds of thousands of people who are in jail and prison largely because they are disabled and don't have the resources to deal with that disability. It's not just the mentally ill, but it's also children. My clients have gotten younger and younger. I argued a case at the United States Supreme Court last month where we're asking the court to ban death in prison sentences for children who are 13 and 14 years of age. The United States is the only country in the world where we condemn children who are 13 and 14 to die in prison. There are 3,000 children who've been sentenced to life without parole. Only country in the world. I represent kids who are 8 and 9 being forced into the adult criminal justice system where they're raped. Of sexual violence is 10 times greater, where the rate of suicide is 15 times greater. And so age makes you vulnerable. And it's not just poverty, and it's not just mental illness, and it's not just age, it's also race. We've been struggling in this country for a very long time to find our way with race, and we haven't really got there. We see these institutions, and many sociologists are now talking about mass incarceration as the fourth institution that has shaped the lives of African Americans. There was slavery. And we really haven't reconciled ourselves to what the history of slavery has done because we don't like to talk about it. We haven't actually thought about what it did to not only people of color, but whites. It's so corruptive to be taught and to believe that you're better than another human being because of your color. The second institution, of course, was terror. And we don't kind of think about this, but after Reconstruction until World War II, there was an institution that was very alive in this country, and it was terrorism. People of color had to worry about being lynched. They had to worry about being bombed. They had to worry about the threats that came with racial violence. In fact, older people of color come up to me all the time and they say, Brian, when you give those speeches, tell people to stop saying that we're dealing with terrorism for the first time in our nation's history after 9/11. They get mad when they hear that on TV. They say, you tell them that we grew up with terror. We had to worry about being bombed. We had to worry about being lynched. It's terror that put us on the other side of the railroad tracks. It's terror that created these communities. And of course, following the institution of terror, there was Jim Crow, apartheid, segregation. And we think we know about that, but we really haven't even come to grips with that. You know, most countries that have dealt with gross human rights violations have recognized that you cannot move forward unless you commit yourself to a process of truth and reconciliation. You've got to sit down and tell the full story about all of the difficulty, all of the damage, all of the trauma that was created by this kind of injustice. You've got to document it. In South Africa, there was this process where people came and they told their stories about how humiliating it was to to live with apartheid, how devastating it was to be marginalized. And only after that process can we start reconciling ourselves to a future. In Rwanda, there's been a recognition that we can't get past the genocide without a commitment to truth and reconciliation. But in this country, we just moved on. Didn't want to take time to tell the truth about Jim Crow. We didn't want to take time to talk about the scars. We didn't want to take time to talk about the tensions. And I believe this failure to commit ourselves to truth and reconciliation is what keeps too many of our churches segregated, too many of our lives segregated, and this tension in the air. And race makes you vulnerable in our criminal justice system. It's very easy to imagine how this new institution can take on these forms and features and there be indifference. Now, I represent people on death row. I see it quite a bit. Death penalty in this country has been largely influenced by race. You're 11 times more likely to get the death penalty if the victim is white than if the victim is black. 22 times more likely if the defendant is black. And we've been making these arguments, but every time we go to the court, we're rejected, we're turned away. I was giving some lectures in Germany about race and the death penalty. It was fascinating after I finished this lecture to see a German scholar stand up. And she said that, of course, in Germany, we can never have the death penalty again. And the room got very quiet. She looked around and she said, we don't talk about this much, but we understand that our history requires us, obligates us to never again engage in the systematic killing of a human being. Can't do it. We've been disqualified. We cannot respect this past and embrace that future. And I thought about that on the plane trip back, thinking, well, yes, how is that? And as I got back to my state of Alabama, I began thinking, what would it feel like if we lived in a world where the nation state of Germany was still engaged in executions? How could I reconcile myself to that world if in that nation state, the victims of the death penalty there were disproportionately Jewish? And the more I thought about it, the more outraged I was. And I had to say, I could not make peace with that. But when I got off the plane in Alabama and Georgia and Mississippi, and I walked through these states where there are buried in the ground the bodies of lynched men and women, I had to go to death row and make these arguments where we persist. Well, I tell you all of this because I believe that we have to create a new conversation, a hopeful conversation, a conversation rooted in faith, a conversation rooted in belief, a conversation that understands that sometimes you have to believe things you haven't seen. Sometimes you have to get past the pain and the anguish. Sometimes you have to replace the hatred with some hopefulness. And I'm here because I believe there is no community in this country capable of leading this conversation other than the church. You know, I'm one of these people who grew up in the segregated South. I'll admit to you that I have burdens. I've been weighted. I've been kind of beat down by some of the things. I had to go to the segregated school when I was a little child. We drove past the public school, and I had to go to the colored school, and the colored school wasn't much bigger than this stage, and it left some scars, and I had to deal with a lot of racial taunting and a lot of racial animosity, and I remember when the lawyers came into our community and opened up the public school, and but for that witness, I wouldn't be here today. But I'll be honest with you, I'm still burdened in many ways by that. I don't like it when people start talking about the good old days. In my state, we still celebrate Confederate Memorial Day as a state holiday. We still have a state constitution that has this Jim Crow language in it. And I'll tell you, I don't like it. I get uncomfortable when I see the flags. I get uncomfortable when people romanticize and get sentimental about this era that was so devastating and humiliating to everybody I know. And it keeps me a little unbalanced. I was going to a prison not too long ago to represent one of my clients. And I got to the prison and I saw this truck out there. And it was like a monument to the old South. This truck had all of these Confederate flag bumper stickers. And it had all of these guns and all of these other slogans. There was a bumper sticker on the truck that read, quote, "If I'd known it was going to be like this, I'd have picked my own cotton." And when I saw it, it was just kind of sad to me. And I went inside the prison, and there was a guard there who I hadn't met before. And this guard came up to me, and he said, "What are you doing here?" I said, "I'm here for a legal visit, sir." And this man said, "Well, you got to get in the bathroom and get strip searched." I said, "No, no, no. Lawyers don't have to do that." He said, "Don't tell me what you have to do. If you want to get in, you got to do that." He was really difficult person. So I went in there, and I went through this search, and I tried to sign the book to get in. He said, "No, no, no. You come back here and sign it the right way." And finally, I was going to go see my client. He grabbed me by the arm and he said, "Did you see that truck out there?" I said, "Yes, sir, I saw that truck." He said, "I want you to know that that truck is my truck." I went inside the prison. I sat down with my client. My client came out. I hadn't met him before. And the first thing the client did when he sat was ask me, "Did you bring me a chocolate milkshake?" I said, "No, I didn't bring you a chocolate milkshake. I'm your lawyer. I'm not here to bring you a milkshake." And I was thinking, this is a really difficult day. And I started asking my questions. And about 20 minutes into it, I realized my client wasn't with me. He was hung up on something, and I thought, he's still hung up on this milkshake. So I went back to him and said, "Look, I'm sorry. I didn't know you wanted me to bring you a chocolate milkshake. Next time, if they let me do that, I will do that." And when I said that, I could go for it with the interview. Very disturbed person. And every time I went to see this man, this is the ritual I had to go through. I tried to bring you a chocolate milkshake. They wouldn't let me do that. I'm sorry, I'll keep trying. Then he would calm down. Well, it came time to go to court in that case. We'd done a lot of work. This man was a victim of the foster care system. He'd been in a house where at the age of 10, the foster parents actually abandoned him. They actually took him out into the woods, tied him to a tree, left him a mile from the road. He was actually found by hunters 3 days later, malnourished. They put him back in another foster home where things didn't get much better. He was drug addicted and on the streets by the time he was 14. He was psychotic by the time he was 16. And he was arrested and charged with a murder when he was 19. And it came time to put his life story in evidence, which is a lot of what we do. And we went to court to present this case. And when I got there, I was concerned because this guard that had treated me so nasty was the guard that had brought him from the prison to the courthouse. And I went over to my client. He asked me the same questions about the milkshake, and he was fine. And we started putting on our evidence. We started talking about the contours of this man's life. We started talking about the things that had gone on that had been mistakes, that were failings, that were our failings. And we put on our evidence. After 3 days, I felt pretty good about the case. I went back home, and I went to the prison to see him about a month later. And when I got to the prison, I walked inside, and there was the guard. And as soon as I walked through the door, the guard saw me coming, and he said, "Hello, Mr. Stevenson, how are you?" Completely threw me. I said, "Well, I'm fine." I said, "I'll go in here and start getting ready for the search." He said, "Oh, no, 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 sir. You don't have to worry about that." I said, "Well, thank you. I'll go over and sign the book." He said, "I already signed you in." I said, "Well, I appreciate that." And I said, "I'm just going to go in and see the client then." And he grabbed me by the arm. And something unbelievable happened. He said, "Mr. Stevenson, I want to tell you something." He said, "I was listening in court. And I want you to know that I was in the foster care system too. And I didn't have it very good." And then he said, "I want you to know I appreciate what you're doing for this man." Could not have believed it. I do a lot of work trying to challenge poverty. I do a lot of work trying to challenge discrimination. I do a lot of work trying to challenge all of these imbalances. And sometimes it doesn't feel like any of that lessens the burden. But that lessened the burden. Because in that moment, there was something like reconciliation. In that moment, there was something like redemption. I said, "Thank you for sharing that. I can't tell you how much that means to me." I was about to go in and see my client. He grabbed me by the arm and he said, "Oh, wait, I got to tell you something else." I said, "What's that?" He said, "Well, I did something when I brought your client back to the prison." He said, "Well, I took an exit and I took your client to a Wendy's and I got him a chocolate milkshake." Now, it sounds unbelievably silly, but I believe that something as simple as a chocolate milkshake can be a path to the message and mission of Christ. Can be the witness that transforms a society that's become hopeless about too many things. Our society has been flooded with the politics of fear and anger. And we need a church. We need believers. We need communities that understand that they must shield themselves from fear and anger. The message of Jesus is a message that says, don't be afraid. The message of Jesus is a message that says, don't give in to anger. When we allow ourselves to give in to fear and anger, we are perpetuating the problems that have created mass incarceration. And so what I'm asking you to consider is that you step closer to these broken communities. I will tell you that when you do it, there will be anguish. I represent these clients. We had somebody executed just last year. And when you stand with people who are executed, it can be overwhelming. Even though I've done it a bunch of times, I never get used to it. And this man was facing execution, and I was really overwhelmed by all of it. And he would call me on the phone the night of the execution. We had tried very hard to get a stay. He didn't have a lawyer. He missed all of his deadlines. It was very frustrating to be trying to help him at this late stage. Every court was saying, too late, too late. And I was on the phone with this man a few minutes before the execution, and it was just having a hard time. I'll tell you a story. When I was a little boy, my grandmother used to take me to church, and I met a boy one day in church, and this boy wasn't somebody who we had met before. And I remember this really clearly. I was about 9 years old, and this little boy started talking, and he had a very severe speech impediment. And when I heard him talking like that, and I'd never met anybody like that, I started to do something that was ignorant. I laughed. And my grandmother gave me this look she had never given me before. And she pulled me over, and she said, "Don't you ever laugh at somebody because they can't get their words out right." And then she said, "Now you go back over there and you tell that boy you're sorry. And then you hug that boy. And then you tell him you love him." I said, "Mama, I can tell him I'm sorry. And maybe I can hug him, but I can't go over there." And she gave me that look again. And so I did. I went over to this little boy and I said, "Look, I'm sorry." And I was 9. I gave him kind of a young person's junior high mini man hug. And then I said, "And I love you." And I never will forget this child holding me back and saying, I love you too. And I think that's why this call was so difficult that night, because this man I was talking to also had a very severe speech impediment. And we were getting closer to the execution. He was trying to get his words out. You could tell the pressure and the attention. And all he was trying to say was, thank you for standing up for me. Thank you for fighting for me. I love y'all for what you've done. But it took him 20 minutes. And before I knew it, the tears were running down my face. And finally, when he finished, I hung up the phone. I thought, you know what? This is too hard. Don't want to do it anymore. I had to have one of those conversations that we have to have sometimes where you start asking yourself, well, why do you do this? You can't make peace with this. This is painful. And I started to have that conversation, and I realized that I had to get to the source of it. And as I sat there, I realized that I don't do this because I think it's important. And it is important. I don't do it because I think it needs to be done. And I started to ask myself, well, why do you do it? Don't do it because there's any money in it. There's no money. I don't do it because it's fun. It's not really fun. I don't do it because it's kind of gets you to kind of talk about things that matter to you. I don't do it because you work with great people. I don't do it because it has to be done. I realized in that moment that why I was crying about this man is because he seemed so broken. Why I was so devastated, I just didn't understand in that moment why we feel this need to kill broken people. And as I began having this conversation with myself about why I do this, I couldn't come up with any good reason for why I'm doing this, why I should keep doing it. And then I realized it was almost as if God was talking to me, and I had to admit something to myself. I do this work because I'm broken too. I'm broken. And I realized it. And proximity to suffering will break you. Proximity to poverty and injustice will crack you. Proximity to bias and inequality will shatter you. And even though you might want to run from it, even though you might think it's dangerous, I'm going to call you to embrace it, to become part of this broken community. Because ultimately, that's what I think Jesus wants from us. You see, I learned in that moment that when we're broken, we realize things that we wouldn't otherwise realize. My clients have taught me some things that I didn't know before. My clients have taught me that each of us is more than the worst thing we've ever done. I believe if somebody tells a lie, they're not just a liar. I think if somebody takes something that doesn't belong to them, they're not just a thief. I think even if you kill somebody, you're not just a killer. And because of that, there's this basic human dignity that must be respected by law and by human beings who understand the power of grace. My work has also taught me that in this country, the opposite of poverty is not wealth. I don't believe that. I believe in too many places in this country, too many places around the world, the opposite of poverty is not wealth. The opposite of poverty is justice. And if we're really concerned about ending poverty, we've got to be more concerned about creating justice. And finally, as a broken person, what I realize is that if we as a community believe that every valley shall be exalted, if we believe that the mountains can be made low, if we believe that the rough places can be made straight and the crooked places can be made straight and the rough places can be made plain, then we have to believe that we can do better for our children than to throw them away at ages 13 and 14. We have to believe that we can do more than execute the broken people. We have to resist a society that tells us that the solution to our fears and our angers is to incarcerate everybody. And so my message is very simple. I want us to come closer, to get close enough to the broken, get close enough to the condemned, get close enough to those who are suffering that we are broken and that we can appreciate that if we're broken and we allow grace to fill those cracks, we'll realize that grace is greater than pride. If we allow mercy to fill those shattered spaces, we'll realize that mercy is stronger than condemnation. If we work with the communities of people that have been broken and ostracized, we'll realize that love is greater than hate. Jesus is very clear. He's told us this. He tells us that we won't be judged by the beauty of our cathedrals. We're not going to be judged by how many congregants we have in our churches. We're not going to be judged by even the power of our ministry and the power of our music. He tells us that none of that is going to be essential. He tells us we're going to be judged by how we treat the poor. He tells us that we're going to be judged by how often we go into the jails and prisons and stand with the condemned, how we feed the hungry. And because of that, I'm excited about what this represents. Reinhold Niebuhr, the great American theologian, said that only the church can deal with the most difficult and vexing problems. Because Christians of real faith understand and believe that when you are motivated by love, you can do some things. And so Niebuhr calls us to have love as our motivation and justice as our measure. What has the Lord required from us? That we love mercy, that we do justice, and that we walk humbly with him. Thank you very much.
Well, it's sobering to hear Brian describe what's happening, the statistics, and to better understand this. But now that we understand it, there's ways in which we need to be vocal about it. We need to be involved. We need to better understand what's happening in our own states, our own counties, our own cities, and just start to figure out what is it that we can do? What can our churches do? How can we be more aware of the plight of so many who really haven't received justice in the way that we would just assume it's happening? In addition to that, I think in the last few years, there's been a much better understanding and a raising of the issue of race and racism and how it's played out. At the time that this talk took place, that was not a mainstream conversation happening. Well, now it is, and so there's more and more opportunities to continue to engage this as we see things from police brutality to other issues that pop up that show racial bias. And the incarceration system is one of the places, many would argue, is where this type of racism has been institutionalized. And so as we say at Q, let's continue to stay curious on this, think well about it. And then if there's ways in which in your own state, community, to better understand and work on these kinds of issues, or just pass this podcast along to people that you know that care about justice, or maybe just have never been aware of this kind of thinking or this topic, encourage them to listen to it. You can also see it on our website at qideas.org, where we'll feature this talk this week and share that with friends as well. I look forward to our next episode. Hope you have a wonderful week. This show is made possible in partnership with Faith Radio and Northwestern Media.
Thank you for listening to the Q Ideas with Gabe Lyons podcast. These conversations are available because of listener support. You can make your gift now at myfaithradio.com. To avoid missing future editions of Q Ideas with Gabe Lyons, subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or on your podcast player. And thank you for sharing this audio link with a friend and growing the impact of Q Ideas with Gabe Lyons.